Well, good evening.
Good evening.
So good to see each everyone here tonight. I want to welcome back our visitors. We're glad that you chose to be with us this evening. Many of you have told me after services this morning and this evening about the length of the sermon this morning, how much you liked that 19-minute length. or didn't like. Some of you didn't get as long a nap as you were planning. What you didn't know was that was so I could get away with my 55-minute lesson tonight. No, I only plan on those on Super Bowl Sunday night. As promised, this morning we're going to be looking at a lesson entitled The Mind of Christ from Philippians chapter 2, 3 through 8. So I invite you to turn over there with me to Philippians chapter 2. And as you're turning over there, I want you to consider with me that as Christians, whether you're a Christian or not, there's choices that are made every day. We must make choices every day. For a Christian, this is something we need to be mindful of, and that we need to let our light shine every day from the moment we get up to the time we close our eyes. People are watching us, whether it's our family, our friends, our neighbors, our loved ones. Our example and reputation are necessary to be lights. Matthew 5:16, we're to let our light shine in such a way that others will see it and they will glorify God. Philippians 2:15, that Paul told the Philippians that they were lights in the midst of a dark and crooked, perverse generation. Now, for a preacher, choices are necessary too. We have to think about what we're going to present and what we want people to get out of it. I've told Becky before, I have a long list of sermon ideas that were scrapped because I thought, wow, that would be the beginning of a great lesson, but I don't really know where to go with it. I don't really know what I want people to take from that. And it's certainly, I think almost every preacher would probably say there's hit and miss, right? We try to decide what is necessary. What do we want people to get out of it? Well, I want to share with you a little bit of my thought process for tonight, because tonight was not a planned topic. You see, I knew how busy my summer was going to be. I knew my parents were coming in. I knew I was going to be leaving for Tampa this coming week. I had been invited to this preacher workshop many months ago, and so there's been buildup to that. I knew that this was going to be a busy time, so I had a kind of my lesson plan all plotted out throughout June. I knew what I was going to be doing every month, and with the Godly Women series that I started in January, I knew at least in the middle of the month what the topic's going to be. I had everything planned out through June, through July, all the way into August, because I had requests to talk about baptism, I had requests to talk about prayer, and so I was going to kind of dovetail those together and combine them and kind of work through those and through July and August. So I had all of that planned out, except for tonight. I looked at my block of time, all my Sundays, and said, I know what I'm doing each Sunday morning and Sunday night, except for tonight. And I was reminded of the old story. Some of you have probably heard that story. I'm reminded of the story of the preacher that was facing a similar dilemma. What to talk on? And he decides, I'm going to let God guide my thoughts on the topic, the subject that I'm going to preach on. So he says, I'm going to close my eyes, open the Bible, and just point to a passage, and that'll be the subject. And he opens his eyes to Matthew 27, verse 5, where it says about Judas, he went out and hanged himself. And he says, that sounds like the beginning of a good lesson, but what do I want people to get out of it? So he does the same thing. And he opens his eyes and his fingers on Luke 10, 37, where Jesus says to the lawyer, go and do the same. So maybe not the best way to figure out how to present a lesson. But the way tonight came about was in a similar fashion. It's not the same way. I was looking through Philippians 2 for a completely unrelated, different matter, a discussion that came about with me and then someone else, and I was looking through Philippians chapter 2, and as I read through that, I read it in a different way than I had before. Lots of times when we look at Philippians chapter 2, and we're going to be starting in verse 3, lots of times we start in verse 5, and we talk about the sacrifice that Jesus made, giving up heaven to come for us, how obedient he was to the point of death on the cross. But as I was reading through that, I was looking... Something jumped out at me about the application for us out of this passage. And that's what I hope to share with you this evening. Going back to choices that we make every day, our example and influence are very necessary to maintain. We need to make sure that our reputation, our influence is intact, certainly for our children, certainly for our spouse, certainly for our friends and family, but our coworkers, our classmates, everywhere we go, we need to be mindful of that. So how do we accomplish this? How do we make the right choices? Romans 6, 3 through 13 tells us that once we are baptized, we walk in newness of life. That is a new set of priorities. new way of thinking of things. Where once we might have got up in the morning with no care of what anyone thought of us, no care of what people were thinking about us as they watched us in action. Once we are walking in this newness of life, we are conscious that we need to be representatives of Jesus. We need to reflect His light in all that we say and do. So it comes down to our attitudes. And that's why I want us to look in Philippians 2, 3 through 8. This lesson could certainly be entitled The Attitude of Christ, as easy as I've entitled it The Mind of Christ. In Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Notice verse 5. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. The King James, New King James read, have this mind in yourself, which Christ had, who although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. You know, when it says we're to have this attitude in ourselves, it makes us think about Jesus and his attributes and the attitudes and the mindset that he had. Because verse 3 tells us with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Verse 5, have this attitude, New King James says, mind in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. You know, as Paul was writing this letter to the Philippians, he sought to get men to bring their thoughts into captivity to Christ. 2 Corinthians 10:5. He says that's one of the goals of preaching is we want to take captive every thought to the obedience of Christ. In Proverbs 4:23 and Proverbs 23:7, the heart or the mind is the control center of life and conduct. What is in our heart, what is in our mind is going to come out in actions and words. In Mark chapter 7, 21 to 23, Jesus declared the power of perverted thought to influence action. What's in our heart is going to come out. It's only a matter of time. Whether we're that individual that just immediately says whatever enters our mind, or whether we're that person that just saves it and thinks about it and stews until that root of bitterness springs up and we just lash out. If we have those kinds of thoughts in our heart, they're going to come out. Jesus speaks about that in Mark 7, 21 to 23. So if Jesus Christ is the center of our life, kind of as we talked about this morning and looking at the parable of the sower, as we looked at the reactions of the four soils and asked, what kind of soil are we? Are we that beside the road soil if you've never even obeyed the gospel? Are you that rocky or thorny place that just receives it, but as soon as trouble comes away, you fall away, or you let the cares of the world choke it out slowly? Or are you that good soil that produces fruit? If Christ is the center of our life, then we'll truly have the mind or the attitude of Jesus Christ. One of the three things that I want us to talk about, the first of which from this passage, is that Christ had a loving mind. As we read there in verses 6 and 7 of Philippians 2, it says, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Why did he leave heaven? Have you ever thought about that? Why did he leave? Why did he empty himself, taking the form of the created? Why did he take on the form of a bondservant? He was rich with God in glory. Why would he leave it? 2 Corinthians 8:9 says, he became poor that we might become rich. John 1, 1-3 tells us he was in the form of God. Hebrews 1:2 says he was with God, and he had honor and power and glory. But he gave up that honor and glory for heaven, in heaven, for a life of poverty on earth. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9. In fact, Luke 9:58, he tells his disciples he has no place to call home. We can look in Matthew chapter 10, where he's telling his disciples, who are saying, I will follow you. He's telling them, I have no place to lay my head. I can't promise you security in this life. I can't promise you rest here in this life. He says, but if you follow me, it's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. Your own family will turn on you. Your friends will turn on you. He talks about persecution following them. How poor was Jesus? Luke 9:58, he says he had no place to call home. In 1 Timothy 2:6, it tells us he gave himself a ransom for all. Jesus himself said that while he was alive. He came to be a his blood, his life to be a ransom for many. So why did he give up his home in heaven? What was his motivation? As we read through the scriptures over and over, we find that motivation is love. Romans 8, 35 to 37 says, "Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword?" Look at what he's talking about in light of the four soils we talked about this morning. He's talking about, well, tribulation, especially tribulation because of the word, as Mark 4:17 talked about, or distress or persecution. Certainly, we may be persecuted for being Christians. That happens in the form of verbal abuse, physical abuse, even death. We're going to be talking about that as we talk about the thorny soil or the rocky soil in detail next Sunday night. But just recently, as last month, there were headline news that 95 Christians were killed in a village in Mali. In fact, the mayor of that city said it was a third of their village's population that was wiped out. That happened on June 9th. It's still happening today. Some persecution is calling upon Christians to make that ultimate sacrifice. It's still happening today. It's not just a first century concept. We need to be ready to persevere in our faith, whatever that consequence might take. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? He says, well, tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness. That talks about how severe that famine might be, how bad things might be in our life that we can't even afford clothing. He says, or peril or sword. Then verse 36, just as it is written, "For your sake we're being put to death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us." Jesus Christ loved us. That's why he gave up heaven. That's why he came down to earth. That's why he lived the life that he led. In Ephesians chapter 5, 1 to 2, I'm also reminded of 2 Thessalonians 2, 16 to 17, and Hebrews 12, 1 to 3, but ask you to read those on your own. Ephesians 5, 1 to 2 says, "Therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma." He says God loved you enough that he was willing to sacrifice himself for you. And he says that's the kind of love you're to show others. We're to love one another as Christ loved us, sacrificially, selflessly. In fact, Hebrews 12, 1 to 3 says, "For joy, despising the shame, he went to the cross." And it tells us why, so that we do not lose heart. You know how easy it is in this life to lose heart. With all the distractions that happen, sometimes they are sad distractions. Sometimes there's things that bring us down. Those are weeds Satan uses to distract us from the fruit that we're to be bearing. Those are things that Satan's going to use to put in your way to make you dwell on those things and not on Jesus Christ. But the Hebrew writer reminds us he endured all those things. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross so that you and I don't grow weary and lose heart. Saints are to be like Christ and put on love, Colossians 3:14. Ephesians 5:2 we just read says, "Walk in love as Christ loved us." Colossians 3:14 says we're to put on love. And that word "put on" means to adorn. It means to put it on like a clothing, like a garment. Philippians 2:1-4 tells us, "Out of love and humility, look out for the interest of others, not just your own." You know, we can see this in example in 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 5. I want you to place a marker there in Philippians 2. We're going to come back to our reading. But look over with me in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, briefly at verse 5. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 5. Paul is reminding the Corinthians, and as you go through reading chapters 8 and 9, he's going to remind them of a promise they made a year before. This is as they're gathering up funds for the needy saints in Judea and Jerusalem. And the brethren at Corinth had obviously, they pledged some amount. We're not told what it is. But a year goes by and they still had not given that gift. And so Paul is reminding them in a very gentle way here by giving an example of the poverty of the church in Macedonia. And he tells them they gave of themselves first to God and great things happened. So read with me in 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 5. We're going to back up to verse 1. He says, "Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God, which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. This kind of lends you to believe that Paul didn't want to take their money. He sees they're in deep poverty, and he says, no, you need it. They had to beg him with much urging to cause Paul and his company to take their money. He says, begging us with much urging for the favor, they looked at it as favor of participating in relieving the saints in Jerusalem. When Paul says their own state was just as bad or worse, he says they were in deep poverty. He says, verse 5, and this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. So by giving themselves first to the Lord, out of their deep poverty, they overwhelmed Paul with their liberality and their gift to the saints at Jerusalem. And as you continue reading through chapter 8 and chapter 9, Paul's going to remind the Corinthians, you made a promise, you need to keep it. And he tells them that the church there in Macedonia, who hardly had anything, they had to beg for the favor of participation, but they did it. Out of love and humility, we're to look out for the interest of others, not just our own. One of those distractions that Satan gives us is in those hard times, when we start feeling, woe is me. We're focused on the woe is me and not the other people around us that might be dealing with far worse or greater things than we are. It's a tool that Satan uses all the time. I'm reminded of Elijah when he hid in the cave, when his life was in danger by Jezebel. She had put to death 100 or so prophets already, and she was seeking his death specifically. And he's hiding in a cave, and God gently comes to him in a gentle wind, saying, Elijah, why are you here? Remember that? And he's saying, take my life. It's over. I'm done. I'm ready to die. Woe is me. And he's having a pity party in the cave. And God is very gentle with him, saying, why are you here? You have work to do. I still need you out there. And Elijah's saying, oh, just take my life. Would that I would die. And he says, there are 7,000 who have not yet bent the knee to Baal. And Elijah's over there saying, I'm all alone. Woe is me. Sometimes we're in that cave with Elijah, aren't we? Sometimes we can have that same pity party. Woe is me, I'm all alone. Look beyond yourself. That's what Paul is reminding us here in Philippians 2, 1 to 4. Out of love and humility, look out for the interest of others, not merely our own. The churches of Macedonia were poor, but they wanted to participate in giving for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Verse 3 says they gave according to their ability and beyond their ability. And they didn't do it because Paul said they needed to do it. They did it out of begging him to take what they had to give. And it made the gift all that much more sweet. If you have the attitude of Jesus, out of love, you will put others first. We also see that Christ had a humble mind as we continue our reading in Philippians 2 and verse 8. It says he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Saints are to have that humility of mind that Christ had. Colossians 3:12 tells us, put on humility. Again, that put on means to adorn, to wear as a garment. When we get up in the morning, we're to put on compassion, put on humility, put on love. Romans 12:3 tells us one is not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. That's what the Philippians were reminded of in our passage we read in Philippians 2, 3 through 4. 1 Peter 5, 6 to 7, humble-minded people are to be dependent on the Lord, casting our cares on him. Why? Because he cares for us. He loves us. Ephesians 4, 32, humble-minded people are forgiving. We're told that we are to forgive as Christ forgave us. That means not forgiving, saying, yeah, I forgive you, but when the time comes, I'm going to hold it over your head. No, that's not forgiving. And that's certainly not the way Christ forgave you. We need to be reminded of Matthew 18 in the parable of the ungrateful servant. He threw himself at the mercy of the king because he owed a debt he could never repay, and the king forgave it all. But then a fellow debtor, a fellow slave, owed him just a pittance of what he once owed, and he took it out of him violently. And when it was reported to the king said, you should have shown mercy as I showed it to you. And he threw him in a dungeon till all his debt would be repaid. Jesus says, so it will happen to the one that does not forgive one another. So when we're told to forgive as Christ forgave us, We're to forgive as he forgave us. Peter once asked, how many times? As if there's a checklist that we can go down and say, well, brother so-and-so, that's it for you today. Sister so-and-so, that's your last tick mark. That almost is what I think Peter had on his mind. Well, how many times do I have to forgive my brother? Jesus' answer is basically as many times as it takes. You're to forgive that person when they come to you. That's one of the hardest things of being a Christian sometimes, because there are hurts that run deep. But we have to forgive that person when they say, I'm truly sorry. I can't believe I hurt you that way. Please forgive me. We have to let it go. We need to have that humility of mind as Jesus did, hanging on the cross for nothing that he had done, saying, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Humility is often hard to find in our culture, because it is erroneously equated to being weak. Think about that. What movie or sitcom have you seen where the person that's depicted as being meek or humble, that they become the butt of every joke, they're the one kicked around, and they make a lot of fun of the person that's humble? They equate it with being weak. It's actually not. I want you to think about Moses in relation to humility. Numbers 12:3 says, now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. And I want you to ask this question, was Moses weak? It tells us Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth at that time. And that's from God. Was Moses weak? Can we look at the life of Moses and say this was a weak-willed person? This was a person who let others kick him around. This was a person that hid in the corner because he didn't want to jump into action. Could a weak man stand up to Pharaoh and not bend to any of the compromises without giving in? Could a weak man have stood up to the multitude in the wilderness without giving in to their complaints and their grumbling, but time and again chastised them, rebuked them, told them to put their trust in God? Could a weak man talk to God and remind him of his own righteousness as Moses did in Exodus 32:9-14? And here's the context there. Exodus 32 is the passage with the golden calf. While Moses is up on Mount Sinai receiving the very law that he was to give to them, they're creating a god for themselves. And Aaron is telling the people, behold, the God that brought you out of Egypt. And the people willingly gave of their jewelry and all their gold so that Aaron could craft it. Could a weak man talk to God in such a way as Moses did when God said this? God said, Moses, stand back. I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to start over from scratch and make you a great nation. That's a huge compliment to Moses. But Moses reminded God, did he need reminding of his own promises to Abraham? Did he need reminding of his own righteousness? No. But Moses reminded him and told him what the scoffers and the blasphemers and enemies of God would say, that God led them out of Egypt only to kill them all in the wilderness, and they would make that a curse and a byword. Moses interceded on behalf of the people and reminded God of his own promise to Abraham. Could a weak man do that? I want you to think about Jesus in relation to humility. Hebrews 12:2-3 says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, not for anything that he had done, not even for his own benefit. It says, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And ask yourself this, was Jesus weak? Would a weak man have gone through with the plan of crucifixion knowing he could have called more than 12 legions of angels? One legion, according to some historians, means approximately 6,000 troops. Would a weak man, knowing he could have stopped it, go through with it? Matthew 26:53 tells Peter, put away your sword. I have at my command 12 legions of angels. Could a weak man go through the mock trial and face Pilate saying nothing? You know, so many times, and rightly so, we identify with the man who's being persecuted or on trial and he's innocent, and he proclaims his innocence all the way till he's locked up or even executed. And we sympathize with that man. Jesus didn't do that. He says he faced Pilate saying nothing. In fact, it surprised Pilate when he said, "Do you not hear how they're accusing you?" in John 18. "Do you not hear how they're accusing you? Don't you know the power and authority I have over your life? And will you not answer me?" Could a weak man have gone through that? Could a weak man endure the torture and punishment he took without fighting back? Without crying out, "I want my lawyer." Could a weak man endure the cross? Not just for his friends and family, but also his enemies, the very ones putting him to death. In Acts chapter 2, verse 23, Peter reminded the Jews that by the hands of godless men, he was crucified. You see, humility is not weakness. It is strength. It's strength under control. Jesus Christ had the power to stop it, but he went through with it because it was God's will. He said, "Not my own will," there in Matthew 26, "not my own will, but your will be done." That's where humility comes into play. When it's my will against God's, who am I going to subject to? That's when I need to subject myself to God's will, and that's where we become humble. When it's not something that I want to do, but I'm going to do it anyway, because it's what God wants me to do. He gave himself completely to God's will. In John 4:34, he described his mission as it's his food to do God's will. In John 5:30, he sought not his own will, but to do God's will. And we see that in practice in Matthew 26:39. It wasn't just a nice speech that he made. But in Matthew 26:39, praying in the garden, he told his disciples he was in agony to the point of death. And he says, "If it's at all possible, let this cup pass from me. But not my will, your will be done." He put his preaching to practice. And in John 6:38, he said he came down from heaven to do God's will, not his own. It takes more strength of character and will to resist those temptations. It takes more character and strength to do what is right and to be in subjection to God than it does to be rebellious. The natural and easy thing is to strike back. The natural and easy thing is to be rebellious. And we certainly see the Israelites doing that against Moses and against God. But if you have the mind or the attitude of Christ, you will humbly submit to the will of the Lord. And the third thing that came to my mind as I was reading through Philippians chapter 2 is that Christ had an obedient mind. From that same passage in Philippians 2, verse 8, "Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." Hebrews 5, 8 to 9 tells us the Lord became obedient in order to save men, Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9. In his obedience, that Jesus learned obedience. It says there in Hebrews chapter 5, 8 to 9, that the price of obedience was that death on the cross. But through his obedience, he learned obedience, and through his obedience, we learn what obedience is. We learn that it's not my will, but God's. We see that in practice in Jesus. In Luke 22, 42, Jesus was obedient to God to the degree that he could say, "Not my will, but yours be done." Saints are to be obedient as Christ was in order to be saved. Hebrews 5, 9 says he's the source of eternal salvation to all those that obey him. Not just those that claim to obey him, not just those that say, "One day I'm going to obey him," but he's the source of eternal salvation to all those that obey him. There is an evident disrespect for authority today. Ephesians 6, 1-3, we find there's a lack of authority in the home, and that children have an obligation to be obedient to their parents, not only under the old law, but in the law of liberty, the law of Christ. Ephesians 6, 1-3 tells us that children are to be obedient to their parents. If not obedient in the home, what chance do they stand to be obedient to the civil government, the civil authorities, once they leave their parents' house, to people they haven't even met? Romans 1:30, 2 Timothy 3:2 tell us the state of society of children that are disobedient to their parents. All manner of godlessness. Men will be lovers of self, 2 Timothy 3 begins. In Luke chapter 2, verse 51, we're told that Jesus was obedient to his earthly parents, and he grew in stature and favor with men and with God. In Romans 13, 1-7, we can see a disrespect in our time for authority, in rejecting the authority of civil government. Over and over, it seems we read the news. There are more and more people rejecting the authority of civil government. Romans 13, 1-7, Paul says the government doesn't bear the sword in vain. And that if we are, and Paul or Peter tells us, if we're going to suffer in 1 Peter chapter 4, we need to suffer in, for the name of Christ as a Christian, not as an evildoer, not as a lawbreaker. Matthew 22, 21, we're to have that attitude of Christ. There he told his disciples, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Citizens of any country who engage in violent and lawbreaking behavior to protest their government are not in subjection to authority. And it certainly is not the mind or the attitude of Jesus Christ. The solution to this problem of rejection of authority is to have the attitude or the mind of Jesus. That's the solution. To teach the gospel so that men might have that attitude of Jesus. Philippians 2:5, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ. He was loving, he was humble, and he was obedient. If you have the attitude of Christ, you will live a faithful life. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2 tells us in order to have the mind or the attitude of Christ, the mind must be renewed. We must be walking in newness of life, as Romans 6 verse 4 says. 1 Peter 3:15 tells us the Lord must be sanctified. That means set apart in the heart. Philippians 2:5, as we just read in our text tonight, we'll only have the attitude of Christ when we let him be our example. When we have the mind of Christ in ourselves. So the question tonight is, will you let Jesus Christ be your example in love, humility, and obedience? In all that you say and all that you do in life, turn to Jesus as your example. Turn to him as who you want to emulate and be like. And tonight, if you are a Christian struggling with sin in your life, look to Christ and strive to have his attitude in all respects. And if you need to repent, do so now and be renewed. If you're not a Christian tonight, we urge you to become one, to repent and be baptized and let Jesus Christ be the example that guides your life from this point on. If you're subject to the invitation of Jesus, come forward and let your request be known now while together we stand and sing.